Hey everyone, and welcome back to the podcast whose sole reason for existence is to remind you that this world is a beautiful and mysterious place. My guest this time, Austin Rampt, has quite a story to tell. And yeah, often through our conversation, I just had to kind of sit back and absorb what Austin was sharing, because some of it is quite painful. Now, Austin grew up in Southern Florida, and on the surface, his early years looked pretty normal. But as Austin says, underneath, he was restless and trying to find his place. And yeah, there is a trigger warning for some stories of addiction and overdosing in this episode. But really, what is so powerful is Austin's story of resilience. And even at his lowest point, when he was living in Mexico with the Sinaloa cartel, he knew that he could rise above his circumstances, and he began the long process to recovery. And we talk about that. We talk about what it looks like to be in a world where you don't feel like you fit and where you desperately want to. Some of us, our paths are harder as far as finding self-acceptance and self-love. And so I'll let Austin take it away.
Boy, I was just a little ball of anxiety and shame. Like if I could say the two emotions I experienced the most as a kid, anxiety and shame. And you know, the shame was always, I can't let you see me. If you see me, you're not going to love me. I'm unacceptable, all these different things. But those are the very thoughts that prevent that love from going out, you know, and prevent it from coming in, to be perfectly honest.
Had to get on a stage or introduce yourself to a group of people, how would you do that?
Wow. I'm telling you, you're hitting hard out the gate. You're gonna left brain me on this one. So if I were to introduce myself to a crowd of people, who is Austin? So I'm a father of five. I have five kids, and they are not scattered kids. They are kids under the same roof, married to a beautiful woman that is way out of my league. I'm a sober member of a 12-step fellowship. Right. And, you know, there are many things that I do, right. There's companies I own and I do a podcast, and these are all things, but I don't know that I would say that that's who I am. Right. I wouldn't necessarily want to be introduced that way. Like I'm kind of a wanderer that really likes getting into, learning about what makes me tick. Cause I know it'll make me more effective when I'm helping other people discover what helps them to tick.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And I like to ask this question of certain guests. What did you dream about becoming when you were a kid?
Oh, good question. So the only conscious dream I could ever remember having was being a baseball player. By the time I got to college, I refused to declare a major. I thought I kind of liked criminal justice because I liked figuring out why people got arrested, but I quickly flunked out of college because I never went to class and was doing too many drugs. So, but that's the only like conscious thing I remember doing. And I've worked for myself, you know, with the exception of the years I was like fleeing the country. I've worked for myself basically from the age of 18. And largely I think it's because for a while there, I was pretty unemployable. But you know, what's interesting is I've noticed the universe always has a way of pushing me in a new direction. And I know it when it shows up, it just hits me right in the gut. And I tend to follow that intuition when it shows up.
I was going to ask you, is there ever any kicking or screaming when the universe says, hey, we want you to go this direction? Do you ever complain? Because I do.
So much, because a lot of the time the right thing for me means removing the wrong thing that I think I want. And it could be relationships. It could be, you know, I'll give you one example. I I worked in the digital asset space for a number of years, and it was very, very good to myself and my family, right? It afforded us to, you know, pay cash for a house and do all sorts of great things. And then as that was seeming to run its course, I went to work for this company that I just believed in so much. I like, man, I bought so much of their token, and I just knew in my heart, this was going to be such a killer. And it crashed and burned. And you know, it, honestly, I guess it was the place that I was at in my life where I maybe had a week of feeling like, wow, that's a real bummer. And then it was just pick up the pieces and go. Like there was just, and it pushed me in different directions. This being one of them, you know, promoting my book, which I published about 9 months ago, but hadn't really gotten out into the world yet.
Yeah. Yeah, really. I mean, I'm so grateful to you for admitting that sometimes you kick and scream, because you're absolutely right. There is that piece of kind of, and it could be wrapped up in ego and pride and all of these things about, oh, the universe is like, we'd like you to go in that direction. And you're like, but I have this and I have that and I have these things. And it can be, that's the when you have to self-reflect and self-examine and wonder, you know, am I in this, you know, for myself, or am I in this for, to make life better for other people or for the universe to be, you know, one of my guests says her behavior, she wants to be a blessing to people. And when the universe kind of ushers you in another direction, it's usually so that you can be a blessing or a gift to other people. So thank you for being candid about that. I'm so grateful.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
I'd love to ask, are you surprised, or would your kid self be surprised by where you are today?
Yes. I it depends on what age we're talking. Okay. I think there's a certain age that would be surprised I'm still alive today. And then there's a certain age that could not in a million years fathom having 5 happy and healthy children. That I could show up as a father for them today, because there were a lot of years where that never looked like it was going to be a reality. And then the things that I do, you know, occupationally, which just really are avenues to enable me to do the work that I really like doing. And those are kind of crazy too. And they're becoming extremely successful, through really no fault of my own. And, you know, so yeah, I think there's kind of, you know, surprises or, you know, I know you talk about miracles, like some of them feel like that, you know, and I'll share some of them as we go along, I'm sure. But yeah, every day, all the time.
Well, and I think, you know, personally, I think, because I write as well, it's a miracle to even finish a work of art, let alone write a book or finish a painting. And so for me, the fact that I ever finish anything, I think is the most miraculous thing on the planet. But yeah. you have written a book that is a lot longer than anything that I have ever written. And also, you know, deeply, deeply excavates your past and probably memories that maybe other people wouldn't want to remember or revisit or, I don't know, engage with. And so I just want to commend you on your bravery and your fortitude, because, you know, it's one thing to write a book and finish it, but it's another thing to go into the past and examine everything that's happened. During this process, was it ever daunting? Were you ever scared? Did you ever think about, oh, I don't want to write about that?
That's a great question. There was a lot of, I would call them fork in the road moments when I was writing this. So the book took 4 years to write. And it was the interesting thing about it is, you know, like all of us, I had these memories and these kind of stories in my head, but to write them in an actual book format, you've got to get detailed. You have to like really explain how this went down. And I realized along the way that a lot of the things that I remembered maybe didn't happen in the exact sequence that I thought they happened in, or maybe the reasons that they happened, right? The people I was blaming, for example, were not really the ones who were at fault in these particular moments. And so as I was going through this in writing, I was also meeting with my therapist every week and going, okay, like here's the section of the book I'm on and here's what I'm feeling today. And there were a few checkpoints where I went, oh my God, do I want to do I want to write that down? Like, there's no way, you know, for anyone that's actually read the book, it's like, I don't come out of it smelling like a rose, because it was a really shameful, you know, horrific part of my life. And it was a big part of my life. But I think if I would have curated that or not been completely honest about those points, the reasons for me writing them would have been kind of null, because, you know, for anyone that's wondering, nobody really makes any money on a book. There's got to be other reasons why you do these sort of things, right? And unless you're J.K. Rowling or somebody else. But really, the biggest reason is when I got back from Mexico, which is where I kind of fled to, people started saying to me, you've got to write this book. And I was like, yeah, that's sweet. Thanks for saying that. But then I started getting it in my gut, like, hey, man, you need to write this down. And so I trust that when I get that gut feeling that there's a purpose and kind of a reason for it to exist. And I've experienced a lot of those reasons along the way. And most of them were preceded by your honesty really struck me. Mm. And I really want to learn more about you and it's like when somebody reads my book, I'm so honored by it because it's such an intimate look at the worst parts of my life. You know, it's just a wild experience for me, you know?
Yeah. Now, I'm just in awe of your bravery, I guess. And also your book, in one respect, from my point of view, is a service to other people. It is your book is part of the blessing that you're bringing for other people, so that they can read and understand your story, but also see how deeply you descended into this kind of place where you came out. It is possible to emerge out of it. It's possible to heal. It's possible to rebuild. You know, do you ever look back at what occurred? And this is a very general question. It is not meant to, I don't know, minimize or insult your experience, but do you ever reflect back now and think to yourself, oh, all of this had to happen so that I could be here now?
Of course. That's, you know, I mean, all of our lives are the sum total of every action and thought we've had up until this point. And there's absolutely no way that I'd be sitting here doing what I'm doing at this moment with, might I add, the level of peace that I'm experiencing, had I not gone through everything that I had to go through. And there's a big difference between, you know, there was a long part of my life where all of the things I had done were the story of me. They made up who I was, and I carried them around like a backpack full of rocks. And there was a point where I was able to just take ownership and make it my story. It's just my story. It's not me. Right? It's not this person that's sitting in front of you today. And there was a big difference between the story of me and my story. And, you know, when I actually came to terms, and that was through a lot of inventory, it was through a lot of, you know, work in 12-step recovery rooms. It really did shift. And I think a big thing that I had to learn how to do, which was really, really hard for me, was to allow myself to be wrong and to set it right when I am. Because I think that's something that a lot of people struggle a lot with is, oh, wow, I made a mistake and it's okay. You know,
it's true.
Yeah,
it is so true. First, you have to have the self-knowledge to self-reflect and look at yourself and your behavior and what just went down. Then you have to have the humility to be like, oh, I might have made a mistake. And there's, sometimes I look around, I'm like, there's not a lot of self-reflection or humility out there in the world right now. We've got to, how can we figure this out? You know, I'd like to ask, obviously it's in your book, this story, but I was listening to an interview that you were on. It's on your website. And you talked about, you know, being the one in high school, you brought the weed to the parties. And that was kind of your, I'm cool, let me into the party, I can belong sort of thing. So you know, when this, I guess I'm going to call it a descent, but into this descent into addiction, did you have any sense that it was a very slippery slope? And was that the genesis? Was the genesis like being the cool kid who went to the parties? How did this all begin?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So leading up to this point, somehow I had learned in my head, this was complete truth, even though in reality it was false. I had adopted the belief somewhere, and I think it had to do with earlier on in life, which I can explain, but I had adopted the belief that I, Austin, am not enough. And so for me to be able to participate, I've got to bring something to the table. Now, when it came to wanting to participate with kids that were doing drugs, I brought the drugs. But, you know, earlier in life, it was, I needed to be the best at sports. And when I'm the best at sports, I get that love and attention from my dad that I really never experienced much of otherwise. And so I kind of got this feeling in my heart that, okay, when you achieve, when you stand out or you shine, then you're worthy of love. And if you don't, then you're not. And I carried that with me for until my mid 30s. And so the decision to become a weed dealer was really not because I liked the economic value of it or anything. It was because I knew that this was always, I always had the compensation on hand that I needed, because something within me was always off. Did that make sense? The way that I explained it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting to me because, you know, I reflect back on my high school, experience and in the '80s, but we won't talk about that. And I just think about how transactional everything is in high school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't mean it to be. We're kind of operating in these sort of, I don't know, kind of unconscious ways. You know, I had, my thing was very benign, but I don't even think you were alive for this, but at some point in high school, there was like a whole thing where people were making these special bracelets. This is the Midwest, so you might've missed out on this, where, you know, with beads and other things. And then you give them to your friends. It was like a very Midwestern thing. And I got really good at it. And then all of a sudden, the cool kids, quote unquote, who had no time for me generally, because I was a nerd, all of a sudden started buddying up with me, you know, and they said, you know, if you could make me one of those, that'd be great. And so all of a sudden I was like, oh, you know, they want to be friends with me. This is exciting. And I don't even know what's happening anymore, but I'm going to make these for other people. And it just becomes at that age. And for me, I don't want to project onto you, but it was like a slippery slope where I was like, oh, they'll like me. And then after a while, I had no worth anymore. So they stopped talking to me. It's kind of like a survival thing in high school you do when you fall into this sort of thing. We won't even talk about the whole self-love part and self-worth part. That's like a whole other show, but it's a matter of survival.
Functionally and emotionally, your story is identical to the one that I just told, which is kind of like, they want to get something from me. I know that they want something from me, but I'm going to allow them to use me in that way because it does something for me that I can't do for myself. And as a child, you know, of course, high school, I'm a child. And by the way, I'm 43. I'm not that young. I was completely willing to let myself be used in that way. If it meant, you know, that people would let me hang out, that girls would talk to me, that, you know, I felt cool. I was totally willing to do that. And that need for external validation, that, you know, inability to esteem myself, so I had to rely on my environment to do it for me, was I was completely and utterly at the mercy of my environment at almost all times, which, you know, there's no power in that. None whatsoever.
That's absolutely true. It's, oh gosh. I mean, the age I am, I'm like, do I have self-worth? I think I've, it's like a lifelong thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And I thank God for my therapist every single day. You know, I'd love to ask this question. Did you have several moments as you kind of descended into addiction? Did you have several moments where you thought, gosh, this could be a problem? Or was there one moment that just kind of gobsmacked you and you thought, I think things are a little out of control?
Yeah. So this is a great question. So I, my descent into addiction was more like jumping off of a cliff than it was riding a parachute. I was addicted to a substance, opiates in particular, by the age of 15. And I was smoking crack cocaine by 17. So I, you know, yeah, I kind of knew smoking crack wasn't a good idea. You know, I knew, but, you know, at the time, like I wasn't really reflecting. It wasn't that I was desperately trying to fill a hole in my soul. And, you know, I've learned later in life that the thing that I want really more than anything else is deep, intimate connections with other people, right? That is the juice. That's where it all lives. But for me to get that, I have to actually show who I am. And that's the thing that I always feared my entire life was, if you see me, you won't love me. And so drugs and alcohol became a sort of hot wiring of connection. It was kind of like, boom, I can do these and instantly get that feeling of connection that I can't find anywhere else. But eventually over time, obviously they quit working. And so by the time I was 22 and landing in my first rehab, I mean, I had already overdosed a couple of times. I had really, really destroyed my life by the time I could take a legal drink. And so, yeah, I had admitted to what I thought people would call the bottom, but I just didn't know how low I could actually go until I was given the time and the resources and enough mental illness to allow me to do that, you know?
Okay, I'm just going to assume that your family and your parents were beside themselves with this, watching
you. Beside themselves.
Yeah.
Totally. I remember my mom, you know, and this is, so I had overdosed on methadone, Xanax, and crack at the age of, I think, 21. I think it was 21. And I woke up in the ICU. I had, my heart got down to something like 13 beats a minute. It had gotten very, very slow. And I didn't show up for work. And my manager called my mom because I wasn't answering my phone, and they broke into the place that I was living. And what had happened was I'd had a mini heart attack. So I was taking a hit off a crack pipe and my heart just went, nope. And I passed out for like 12 hours. I was in the ICU for 7 days, you know, catheter, stress tests on my heart, the whole nine. And I remember my mom, as she was there, just looking at me and saying, do you want blood? Cause I have nothing left to give you. Like, you've taken it all, man. And, you know, prior to this, I was growing pot in our family home in the closet, and my grow lights caught my clothes on fire, and I burnt our family home down to the ground accidentally at age 17 between my junior and senior year. And so, you know, in a very real sense, like I really did, you know, not intending to, but I really did take everything, you know?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that your manager called your mother.
Oh, me too. Me too.
I'm so glad they broke that door down. I mean, also, I'm so glad that you have such a strong heart. Do you ever, like, reflect on your body and say, I'm so lucky that it never gave up?
Yeah. I actually reflect on that quite a bit, because in Mexico, my intention was to die, and I brought enough money with me to make that happen. And for some reason, the money ran out before my body did. You know, I fully assumed that, you know, with the amount of drugs the cartel was bringing me, and no one was stopping me. It was like, dude, you can do whatever you want. I felt sure that eventually I was going to have a stroke or a heart attack or something was, you know, and, surprisingly it just didn't happen. And, I was very, very lucky, but I watched people. This was the weird part. I would always kind of have people around me who wanted to get high with me. So I'd be like, yeah, come on. And they would try and keep up with me. And I would watch them go like a little bit cuckoo. They weren't able to keep up with me. And I saw that happen multiple times, you know? And so I know the damage that I could have done to myself. And surprisingly, like, I'm in really good health. I mean, that was, you know, it was 12 years ago now, but you know, the body does regenerate, which is a good thing.
Thank goodness.
Right. Right. Totally.
Your mother just must be beside herself with her 5 grandbabies. Oh my goodness.
Oh, she has 8 grandbabies. My brother has 3 also. And so, we've got a pretty big family between the two of us. And then my wife's sister has 3, and there's just, Christmas can get a little bit wild around our house, but it's really, really, you know, it's interesting that So after my first 2 children, Maddie and Zach, who are now 15 and 12, which was with my first wife, I got a vasectomy because I was like, well, we're not having any more kids, clearly. And soon after that, I went to Mexico. So it's probably a good thing I got that vasectomy. And when I came back from Mexico and I met my current wife, she was like, dude, if we get married, like, you got to get that reversed. And I didn't even know that was a possibility. And, so we did, and I did, and we had our daughter, Delilah, who's 6, and it was like, oh, this is amazing. All right. No more kids. Right. And she said, no, I want another child. I said, are you kidding me? Like, we got to start the clock of the kids, you know, growing up and getting out of the house. Finally, I conceded to Nicholas, our 3-year-old. And then a couple of years ago, it was actually on my birthday, I got the phone call and she said, honey, you're not going to believe this. And she was pregnant with our daughter, Skylar, who's 14 months. And I can tell you that looking back, this was an instance that we talked about earlier that I want to share with you, where I fought every step of the way, right? I went kicking and screaming. I did not want what the vision was in my head that this looked like. And make no mistake, having 5 children under one roof is very, it can be difficult. But it's a perfect life for me because I'm just surrounded by that thing that I told you earlier that my heart just sings out for, which is that connection, right? And I've learned I've probably learned more about myself in learning to be a dad than I've really learned anywhere else. And my wife is a really, really good mom. I mean, she's a really good mom. She's been the one that has taught me what it actually meant to be a parent, which I had no clue about, you know? So I know you, so I have a terrible ADD. So I'll go on a tangent. And then I know you asked a question, but I forgot what that question was. But hopefully my answer answered it.
Yes. No, you absolutely. And beautifully. And I think that's such a powerful and beautiful reminder. I mean, I think kids are really fun. Yes, they can be stinkers every once in a while, but, you know, innately, usually they're filled with joy and mischievousness. And, you know, based on my nieces and nephews, I have seen how they keep my brother and sister on their toes. And especially with, you know, the world at their fingertips with the internet these days, they know everything. Whereas when I grew up in the 80s, I just had the newspaper that got delivered every day, and that was how I could even figure out anything. But kids are so wise and brilliant these days, and it's, you know, they're little teachers themselves. And so your answer is really gorgeous because you just continue learning, right? How to be in the world, how to be a parent, how to be present, how to listen, all of these gorgeous things. And they're fierce little teachers. And I love that for you.
Yes, they are. But, you know, interesting story that happened. I So in the 12-step recovery program, there's a line in there that says it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that someday he'll control and enjoy his drinking, which if I'm controlling it, I'm not enjoying it. And if I'm enjoying it, I'm probably not controlling it. And I had a sponsor a while back who said, he said, I would translate that over to your life as well. That if you are the one that has to be in complete control of it, then you're not free to enjoy it. And if you are enjoying it, you're probably giving up control somewhere. And my wife said to me one time, and I used to kind of struggle with being a dad because I needed to grow up myself. And she said to me, honey, it's the kid's job to break the boundaries and it's our job to enforce the boundaries. And if we enforce the boundaries, that then they will trust that we as their parents are going to meet their needs. And if they trust that we're going to meet their needs, then they're free to be kids and enjoy their life. And it was basically the same statement, just repurposed over children. And it my head rolled off my shoulders and onto the floor. And my wife didn't even know what she said to me, right? But to me, it landed so hard. And this was like 4 or 5 years ago. So yeah, that's been a cool experience.
Well, I'm going to state the obvious and just say she's brilliant. Put that out there.
She's very smart. Yeah, she is very intelligent. Yeah.
Is silly to say, but the second main question of the podcast is, because my listeners like to hear about these people journeys like this, and I do too. Did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like?
Yes.
And then how has that, you know, your connection, if you have one still, to the divine or outside of yourself, how has that evolved over time?
So good. I love this question so much. So and I'll preface this by saying, this is my experience. Of course, everyone's going to have a different experience with this sort of thing. So yes, I grew up in a religious household where church was always expected on Sunday. My parents got divorced when I was 13 and my dad was really the religious guy. My mom was kind of like, I'll go along with it, but I really like want to explore what else is out there. And so when I had first gotten sober at age like 22, I went to church and I went there almost superstitiously, I guess I would say. Like if I show up and I do these things, then I'm going to get, you know, a little cookie from God sort of play. And I went there one time and I had gotten, you know, so in early sobriety, I had become a huge fan of Eckhart Tolle. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
Okay. Loved him. And I went to church one day. And they put this thing up on the video monitor saying something like the largest satanic church ever has just been broadcasted with 500,000 members. And then they showed Eckhart Tolle and Oprah up on the screen. And I went, hold on, this is not right. And so I started questioning at that point. And then I started going into the rooms of 12-step recovery and finding out that there were people in there, all of which have at least some slight different conception of what God or their higher power or the divine is, but they all have access to the power. And so it occurred to me that this, and again, this, just for me, anything that says this is the only path didn't become the path for me. And so that actually was not the easier way of going about it for a guy with a raging drug addiction. I probably, had I stayed in the superstition mindset that I had, like, oh, you better tithe 10% or you're going to have a bad work week, you know, that sort of superstition. Had I stayed in that, it might've almost been easier than going, okay, I'm going to try and expand what my definition of divinity actually is and move on. And I'll tell you that, you know, I don't wish everyone has a near-death experience, but I think there's a lot of value when people do. And I've had a couple. And as a result of that, like kind of on the other side of facing mortality, you get a fairly clear picture on, well, what's actually important? Like, what am I really chasing here? And so my experience with God or, you know, the universe has been changing since I was 22. And today, you know, there was a while I wouldn't set foot in a church and then that kind of, I kind of came full circle with that a little bit not participating in church or anything, but like I might read the Bible in the morning, or I've got this really, really cool book called The Gospel of Thomas, which is like that book they didn't put in the Bible because it like tells you some truth they don't want you to know. And I just love it. And where it actually gets down to is that the things that Jesus actually said really reflect the Hindu tradition. They reflect all of these different traditions of what divinity is. And so, you know, today, what that really looks like today in practice is it looks like living a principled life. And then whatever happens, happens. Like we go from there, you know? Yeah, that's been my experience with it.
I just love how you distilled it down to living a principled life. And then we go, that takes so much pressure. I mean, for me, it takes so much pressure off of just showing up in the world, but it also distills it down in with such clarity. You know, you don't have to do 10 different things. Just show up with integrity, you know, authenticity, principled, and everything will flow from that. That's gorgeous. And I'm also just kind of gobsmacked because I did not know about the Eckhart Tolle, Oprah Winfrey, satanic thing going on. You know, I grew up outside of Chicago. So by rights, I should worship Oprah, and I'm not. I mean, I'm ambivalent about her, I guess you could say. Like, I don't feel one way or another. I just am not that. Some people really love her and worship her. Now, Eckhart Tolle, I had no idea that anything that he posited could be considered bad, but maybe I missed those parts anyway.
Well, no, I don't think you missed anything. I think anything that says, so here's where I had come to the conclusion of, you know, this is 20 years later, is that, you know, in this particular church that I was participating in, they had a very particular school of thought, not a bad one in any way, but particular. And anything that was not, this is the one path, was immediately satanic. They just went right over here. And you know, that's, you know, they say if Jesus had been born in India and he walked around saying he's the son of God, they wouldn't have killed him. They would have said, yeah, of course you are, dude. Keep moving. You know, because everyone kind of thinks that, right? Everyone's got that in them, in Eastern religions. So anyhow, yeah, I think it was, you know, it was probably what the pastor's father had taught him. And, you know, anything that doesn't follow our school of thought is definitely of the devil or whatever they say, you know? And so, yeah, so it's not been an easy path. You know, it's actually had a lot of really tragic things happen along the way, but it's been the right path for me, you know, 'cause I'm still here and I'm talking to you about it. So it must be.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say there's one kind of key component, to all of this. And that is, the only way that this kind of works for me is I have to believe in a universe that is loving, right? I've got to, it has to be, the foundation of it has to be, if my intention is to do good and these are the actions that I'm taking, then good will come about. And what I mean by that is like, it's, so there's things in almost every religion, which essentially say, I know the one in the Bible, but it essentially says, if your intention is to please God and you're working towards that, then everything's just working out for you. Things are working out. Even if you don't think they're working out, they're working out. And if there wasn't like a foundation of everything's always working out for good, then I don't know that I could ride that train. But even if I can't prove it, like I can prove the distance between two points, if I believe it, then it's true for me, man. And that's all that I really need, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for that clarification. I mean, I think it's really important. Kind of all of my guests, they kind of lead by example, by explaining their journeys. And a lot of them, I mean, most of them are pretty expansive and generous these days, as far as being willing to include others' points of view, which I think is always good because you never know when you're going to learn something, which might benefit you. You know, I want to go back to the NDEs and your comment about love or the universe being loving, love being this kind of central ground that you anchor to. I've never had an NDE. I've certainly interviewed many people who have had NDEs. Can I ask what your experiences were like? And did you have an experience or a feeling or an encounter with that love that you talk about?
That's a great question. So in my case, because they were drug induced, you know, it wasn't, no, I didn't. But what I can tell you is that after, you know, these experiences, something definitely shifted within me. And I started wanting to explore more about, so back to Eckhart Tolle, right? I think every religion in the world, if you were to sum up the divine, they all kind of use the same word, and that word is love, right? God is love. They always say that. And Eckhart Tolle gives a really good definition of love. And he said, even this, as he says, is not a great definition, but he said, love is the recognition of oneness with another. Like when I see me in you, or you see you in me, that's love. And in a very real sense, that's the experience of divinity. And, you know, so my journey of sobriety has always been in 12-step recovery rooms. And we've got people putting their hands up every single time they share, and I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And we're seeing ourselves and one another in a constant sense there, you know? And so part of whittling down my experience or sharing my experience really is maybe somebody will see themselves in me, or maybe somebody will start to see themselves in themselves. And by saying, wow, if it could happen for this guy, you know, who was way worse than me, you know, maybe there's hope for me. Cause there was always so many things in my life that, boy, I was just a little ball of anxiety and shame. Like if I could say the two emotions I experienced the most as a kid, anxiety and shame. And, you know, the shame was always, I can't let you see me. If you see me, you're not going to love me. I'm unacceptable. All these different things. But those are the very thoughts that prevent that love from going out, you know, and prevent it from coming in, to be perfectly honest. So yeah, that's been an interesting little tweak to my concept of what God is. And I think maybe by next year it'll change. Who knows? Like as more information and experience comes in, it could get different.
Well, that's the adventure and I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me ask you the main question of the podcast, which I would so appreciate it if you could share 1, 2, 3 stories, whatever you feel comfortable with, about something that you considered to be, or you experienced or witnessed it, something magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
I've had so many of those. When I first came back from Mexico, I had nothing. I mean, my whole life had been burnt to the ground. I had, you know, no family left that would speak with me. I mean, I ended up homeless in Mexico City. And, at the end of my journey in Mexico, let me start with this. I had landed in Mexico City. I was living in Cancun, but I had landed in Mexico City. I got my Mexican credentials stolen because I had bribed a government officer to make me a Mexican citizen. And those got stolen. My wallet got stolen. And I was forced to kind of go, okay, well, I can't get back to Cancun. So where am I going to live? And I reached out to this girl and her mom, or this girl, who had taken a liking to me. I had met her months earlier, and she said, you come and you live with me and my mom. And she lived in this little city called Coacalco, which is on the outskirts of Mexico City in the state of Mexico. And so I took a taxi cab out there. It took like 45 minutes. And when I get there, I'm looking around, and like the buildings that I'm looking at are what we would call in the United States projects. They look like projects, right? It's like green, like my hat, cinder block. There's these big water tanks on the top of the buildings. And I don't really know what those water tanks are for. There's clotheslines out with hang. It's not a great, you know, not a great looking scene. And I walk inside of her home and her mom have dinner waiting for me. And I'm a really bad active drug user at this point. Like, I'm a bad junkie. And what I proceeded to experience were two of the kindest, sweetest, big-hearted people that I had ever met in my entire life. And why this was so pivotal in part of my story is that the way that I was trying to fill that not good enough wound back in the United States was if I achieve, right, then I'm worthy. And so I started starting businesses and all these different things. And I had had a good level of success, but that wound was still there. And here were these two people that lived in, you know, what we would consider poverty, who had found happiness and just exuding love from who they were. And on my second day there, I asked her, I said, can I take a shower? And she said, yeah, but you need to wait a few minutes. I thought she was heating up the water heater. Well, they didn't have a water heater. She actually had to heat the water up on the stove and we showered out of a bucket. And that's how she showered too. And it was this thing that was like, wow, you've been chasing all this stuff, but here's happiness right in front of you with none of that. Now, would you call that a miracle or unexplained? Well, looking back, it was such a pivotal moment for me, right? And when I got back to the United States, and I didn't find sobriety right away, but I eventually did. And when Haley and I were dating and we were engaged, I got custody back of my two oldest kids, Maddie and Zach. And I did not know how to be a father. And I was really scared to go make money in the way that I had made money before, which was not at all a bad way, but something in my brain said, the money was the problem. You know, you were a bad guy because of the money. And so I was really scared about making money, but I really wanted to like find some level of success so I could take care of my family. And I had come across somebody on YouTube who you may or may not know. But the YouTube channel goes by the name Abraham Hicks. Do you know who that is by any chance?
Yeah.
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 Okay. So I've been listening to Esther for, you know, 10 years at this point. But so for anyone that's listening that doesn't know who that is, Esther is a woman who essentially channels entities and teaches you a lot about the law of attraction and the universe and different things. And so for an entire year, I would say, when my wife went to work and the kids went to school, I would spend an hour on my couch with Abraham in the background with my eyes closed, just kind of sitting, you know, cross-legged and envisioning what my life could look like. Like, what did I want it to look like? How would that feel? And so a couple of years later, I was not making any money for years after this, but I had started, you know, somebody introduced me to the digital asset space, crypto. And I started, these signs just started appearing for this one, right? And it was, not only were they always appearing in my experience, but I had a basketball roll up to my feet with the name of it on there. And the name was Phantom, and it started with an F, not a P, not a PH, Phantom. And I went, whoa. And I just dumped what savings I had into this. And in the run of 2020 and 2021 after COVID, which was a huge financial run, it was the number one mover in all of crypto. It went like 1,000x, changed our life. And wow. So I, in my mind, can connect it back to the hours I spent sitting on the couch envisioning and feeling what it would be like. Maybe nobody else will, but to me, you know, that was the miracle that showed up. And, you know, it at least took care of the things that I was so scared to take care of, so that I could show up to be a father. Whole lot of learning had to happen after that though. So,
well, it's hard to argue with a basketball.
It's hard to argue with a basketball. I have a picture of it. It was so, and it was like a random word that didn't make any sense. Rolled up to my feet. Crazy.
That is crazy. I've not heard a story like that, but I love it. That is, I mean, how can you argue with that? Especially when you're getting these other signs. And then, I mean, it's like the universe was like, in case you're not paying attention, here's a basketball.
Here's a basketball, man.
I mean, yeah. I think the universe or that field of love or whatever it is has a great sense of humor. I don't know how you feel about that.
Sure. Why not? Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? You know, I've kind of, the way that I feel over time, and this is something I actually learned from Abraham is, you know, how that feelings are really our emotional set point. Like, where are we now, you know, in relation to where we're trying to go. And, I had a point, but my ADD took over and it's gone. So we're going to have to keep moving on, Kirsten,
that's fine.
Which is fine. That does happen all the time. You just snap your fingers. I'll come back. But, I ADD'd on you. It happened.
These things happen.
Yes, they do.
Grateful that Austin chose to be on the podcast and share his really, really intensely powerful story of drug addiction and then finding his way to the other side. I think we need reminders that just because we find ourselves in almost impossible situations, it doesn't mean that we can't find the path or the way out of those places. Sometimes it takes some of us longer than others, but I do believe that each and every one of us has the strength and the fortitude to find our way home. If you want to find out a little bit more about Austin, of course, there's going to be all sorts of links in the episode show notes. So please do check those out, including a link to buy his incredible book, One Last Hit, The Remarkable True Story of an Addict's Journey to Find Himself. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Austin. Never give up. I mean, I am sure I can't even count the times that Austin thought that he wasn't worth it and that he could never begin the journey out of his addiction. But he never gave up on himself and he didn't give up on those who loved him. He kept going, and I urge each and every one of you to do that. Be like Austin and don't give up. No matter what struggles you're facing or what hill you think you have to climb, don't give up on yourself. I know that each and every one of you is loved by so many people, whether it's friends or family, and I know that they all have your backs. So don't give up on yourself just like Austin, and put that first step out there just like Austin. And begin the climb up that hill, believing in yourself, but also believing in everyone who loves you.
Oh, definitely. I would love to do that. So if you want to connect with me, and I am happy to connect with anyone that wants to, you can reach me at onelasthitbook.com. That's my website. And all of my contact information is on there. You can buy the book through there as well, but it's also on Amazon, Audible, all the different places. And what the book is the very detailed, you know, nitty gritty account. I'll show you the cover. There's no question what the book's about if you look at the cover, right? There's a lot going on there. You know, it's not for the children. And but it's the very detailed account of what happened. And, you know, hopefully hopefully somebody finds it helpful. I actually just launched a site 2 days ago called sobrietytalk.com, which is, I noticed that there were places, but not really a place dedicated to sober content creators, because there's a lot of them. There's hundreds of them. And so that's essentially what it is. It's a a voting mechanism where people can rank their favorite podcasts and connect with them and all sorts of different and listen to them on one website. So anyhow, and who knows what next week's going to bring, but right now I'm doing a lot of stuff like this, Kirsten, as I'm just chatting with people and enjoying the experience of it. Really, this has been lovely. I love that. I love chatting with you.
You know, you're enchanted with the universe, but I think the universe is seriously enchanted with you. So do you ever like sit back and think, I'm super cool, because you are. And I would, if I had had a sign like a basketball rolling up to my feet, I'd be like dusting my shoulders off and be like, clearly someone likes me.
You know, I never have really. I haven't. But, you know, if I did go down that road, it would be, I'm super cool. And so is everyone else, you know, like we all are, we're all super cool. I think the biggest thing is the way that I can pinch that off is if I get into a belief that's opposite of that, if I start falling back into the belief of I'm not worth it, or, you know, the shameful stuff, right? That's kind of like we're going to unplug you from the wall now, those types of emotions. So, but yeah.
Oh, I love your humility. There you go.